We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today with Maureen Holtz, who is one of the co-authors of a new book out called Robert Allerton, The Private Man and the Public Gifts. Welcome, Maureen.
Thanks.
Good to have you here in the studio with us. It's a fascinating book. Robert Allerton was quite a guy. He was an amazing philanthropist. At the time he gave the Allerton Estates near Monticello to the university, that was the largest gift ever given to the university.
That was my understanding, yeah.
And the accumulation of things that he gave the Art Institute of Chicago, works of art and money, was the largest they had received at that time.
Right, in 1960, I believe it was. The Tribune had an article in it saying that he was the biggest benefactor to the Art Institute, and that shocked him. He certainly thought it had been somebody else, and but they assured him, no, it was him.
And the Art Institute, to honor those gifts, named the main wing of the Art Institute the Robert Allerton Wing.
Right. And you know, when I lived in Chicago, I saw it a few times, and it kind of stuck in the back of my head. But I never thought much about it other than I recognize that name from somewhere.
Uh-huh. So if people go up between those lions there on Michigan Avenue, up the steps to the Art Institute, there to the right, carved in stone, is Robert Allerton's name.
Mm-hmm.
He also had a fascinating private life. He was almost deaf.
Right,
he had
right.
a major hearing problem. You tell in your book about a romantic love relationship perhaps with a woman, but also with men.
Yes.
Well, we'll talk about that later in the program, but let's start off with how you happened to write the book. Your co-author is Martha Bergen.
Right.
Tell us about her.
Well, Marty and I would get together periodically to chat and discuss our writing, et cetera. And one day, Marty and I were talking about the book that we each had in the back of our mind that we thought needed to be written, and it was a book about Allerton Park. We didn't feel that there was, you know, a book out there that could adequately do justice to the park. And when we both discovered that that was something we both had in the back of our minds, we decided, after saying, well, why hasn't this ever been done? We decided, well, why can't we do it? We're both writers, and my husband's a very good photographer. So why don't we team up together and come up with this plan? So we thought we could turn it out in about 6 months, and then 2 years later, we were finally done.
And the result is Robert Allerton, The Private Man, The Public Gifts. Since this program deals with not only aspects of religion and spirituality, but also about ethics and values, someone who is such a generous man, such a philanthropist, I think is a worthy topic for us to discuss. And of course, listeners are encouraged to call in with comments or questions. Let me give the phone numbers, 333-9455 if you're in the 217 area code near Champaign-Urbana. If it's a long-distance call, do use 1-800-222-9455. And, of course, the program is heard online, so we may have people calling from far away who are listening to this as it's broadcast and heard through their computers or phones or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We welcome calls and comments. This is a live program, and we're broadcasting today on July 18th. Maureen, when you and Marty started writing this book and you started getting into the life of Robert Allerton, how did you divide up what you were doing as writing partners?
Right. Well, that's a good question. Marty's background, she spent 30 years as a graphic illustrator at the University of Texas in Dallas. And I, my background, even though I didn't, you know, work in it, my background was in history and Spanish, but I didn't get to use Spanish here. So we decided to split it up along the lines of art and architecture, and the gardens would be Marty's background, and mine would be all the historical and social relationships, because that just seemed like a natural break point. And we put together what we thought would be the areas that we needed to cover and divvy them up, and went on, and were very, very much involved in each person's writing. Somebody would write a chapter and send it to the other person, and we'd go back and forth through it. So each chapter had our sets of eyes on it, probably at least 20 times, if not more.
Now, since this program is heard widely in Indiana as well as Illinois, some people may not know about Allerton Park at all.
That's right.
How would you describe it to someone who knew nothing?
Okay. I thought of it as a slice of England in the middle of soybean territory. I only saw it once when I was here going to college. A friend of mine had a car, and we drove out here, and I was absolutely amazed at this 40-room Georgian mansion surrounded by artwork and gardens. I had no clue how we got there because I really wasn't paying attention as we were driving. And then later when I married a man who's from Central Illinois, we would periodically visit here when we came to visit his family. So I became more acquainted with Allerton Park then. And then ultimately we moved back here. Now, Marty grew up in Monticello. The property was made up of about 13,000 acres with about 17 gardens, and I can't count how many pieces of artwork and sculpture. Scattered around. So for the people who haven't ever been here, I encourage you to come because, number one, it's free. You can just come and park and wander all over the place, not so much in the mansion, unless there's a tour going on, and that's kind of rare. Groups can arrange for a tour if they contact the people at the park.
But the park was donated to the university with the understanding that it remained open to
right,
the public
right.
As a place for picnics, and of course weddings, or many weddings
right,
are held there.
Right, there's at least two every day, yeah. every Saturday
weekend,
in the
yeah.
summer, yeah. And I've been to a wedding, and it was quite lovely. It was a perfect day, but I wouldn't say every day is a perfect day for having a wedding out there. But it's a beautiful, beautiful landscape.
And you talked about the 17 gardens. One of the things that Robert Allerton and his architect friend and probably lover, John Gregg, designed, they're sort of like separate rooms. You walk from one garden that might be walled to another one that's perhaps open to the sky, another one that has Asian themes, another's in a sunken area.
It's a good mix of seeing what his interest was at that time period in his life.
Yes.
The what is known as a formal garden, where the girl with the scarf is, the garden closest
that's
to that.
That's a sculpture.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. It's a piece of sculpture, not a girl standing there with a scarf. It started off as his vegetable garden.
Wow.
Even though it had roses in there, too, it also had vegetables around it. And he just kept going further and further down the row, so to speak. And for those who get married in the sunken garden, you may not be aware, it was once their dump. By then he was with John, and they designed the sunken garden several times over to the state that it's in now. But yeah, each garden shows a different interest in his life at the time.
I've performed many weddings at Allerton Park. Couples from the university, couples from the community who wanted an outside wedding, and they're very gracious and helpful there as they schedule them and arrange them. But there was one particularly memorable one that I think it was in the sunken garden. Maybe it was with the Foo Dogs. I can't really remember that. But the couple had asked me to read a poem by E. Cummings, a sonnet, and the last line in it made a reference to a butterfly. And just as I read that line, a butterfly landed on the couple's clasped hands.
Oh, my Lord.
It was quite...
That's amazing.
It was quite a scene.
You couldn't have arranged that if you had tried.
That's right.
Wow.
And other times there have been a few other insect problems.
Oh, yeah.
Because it is outside.
Yeah, yeah.
Depending on the time of year.
Yeah.
But it is a beautiful setting. Tell us how the Allerton Park, how the mansion came to be, and how Robert Allerton, having been raised in Chicago and traveled around the world, why did he choose to live near Monticello out in this woods?
And that was one of the questions Marty and I wanted to try and address ourselves, because a lot of people, when they're walking around the park, maybe the first time they've been there, they say, why here? I wasn't quite sure, but in any case, yes, he grew up in Chicago, and he and his best friend Frederick went off to Europe to study painting around 1893, thereabouts, right after the World's Columbian Exposition. And they had fallen in love with, well, they had been artists beforehand, but they really wanted to try their hands at being professional artists. Robert came back around 1897 after having burned his paintings, and we don't know the reason. You know, there's a lot of speculation, and that's all it can be. But he and his father came up with the idea that maybe he should take over managing the farms, as they called them down here. This was the property that his father, Samuel Allerton, used for basically feeding the livestock that he transported from Nebraska and all parts. But Robert, of course, wanted a house that was worthy of him. And his father said, well, why don't you just go off to England and study houses with a friend who was an architect. And they came back with a design based on a house near London called Ham House. And it's remarkably similar if you ever Google Ham House. So that's how the mansion got here. He wanted it intimate enough that it wasn't filled with tons of bedrooms, because, like you said, he was almost deaf, because at the age of 7, he came down with, well, his adopted son called it scarlet fever, another point called it typhoid fever. I'm guessing it was scarlet fever, and it made him and his sister deaf, and it killed his mother. So he wanted not so many bedrooms that he would have a whole flock of guests, but he could have a small intimate group of guests that could come and enjoy the property as he was.
So there were not many bedrooms, but it was 35,000 square feet.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's a huge lot of rooms for libraries. He was particularly fond of books, because not being able to hear very well. And, of course, think about it. You either went to operas. They didn't have movies. They didn't have TV. They didn't even necessarily have records at the time. So operas were it. And if you're down here, there weren't a lot of opera outlets. So he found his refuge in books.
And he also collected many art books, many first editions. Let's give his dates. He was born in 1873 and died in 1964.
That's
quite
right.
a long life.
He was 91.
And you've mentioned already his adopted son, his foster son first, and then finally they were able to, Robert Allerton was able to legally adopt John Wyatt Gregg in 1960, when the Illinois laws changed, as you explained in your book. Was Allerton possibly involved in getting that law through?
Well, one person told me, who had a legal background, that she believed she thought he was very instrumental in this. And it could very well be. I mean, the Allerton money was pretty prolific. I don't have any proof of it, but my guess is he was quite instrumental in probably in getting the law changed. It changed in 1959, and it was in 1960 that he went in front of a second cousin or something, who was a judge, who allowed the legal adoption. So
this was an adult adopting another adult.
Yes,
and at the time, he was quite elderly, 87,
He was
John
87.
Was 60.
John was 60. They were 27 years apart. They had lived together as son and father since the middle 1920s.
So they had a 40-year relationship by that time already.
Right.
Now, before that, there's some evidence, historical evidence, that Robert Allerton had a gay relationship with English composer, Roger Quilter, Q-U-I-L-T-E-R.
Correct.
Tell us about that.
Well, he was, apparently people from the UK have heard of the man. I had never been, had never heard of him. But he had probably run in the same circles as Robert. Robert was visiting England a lot. His friends, he had a lot of artist friends and writer friends, including Henry James, et cetera, who lived in England, and it's probably in that circle that he met Roger. He wrote two letters that are in the British Library. A Quilter's biographer, I found an email in the archives when I was searching. Between one other person and the biographer. And I contacted her, and she says, oh, these letters are in the British Library. Here's the transcripts of them. And so anyway, they're pretty flowery and talk about, how wonderful life is now that he's found Quilter. And later, there was this friend of Quilter whose son managed to have a conversation with the biographer. And according to this son of the Quilter's acquaintance, the son said that Roger told the man's father that Robert was the only man he had ever had a homosexual relationship with.
Uh-huh. Now, Roger Quilter never never came and lived at the mansion here in Illinois, although Robert Allerton clearly wanted him to,
right.
from the letters that you quote in your book. He apparently was nervous about leaving England, didn't want to leave England, and as much as they may have cared for one another, he never chose to come here and live. Now, the way that Robert Allerton met John Gregg is fascinating. Tell us about the famous luncheon at a dad's day at the University of Illinois.
Well, a lot of people think that that's when he met John, and I'm pretty sure he met him earlier than that. John lived at Zeta Psi fraternity and had two roommates, one of whom's name was Aisler Dighton, and another person whose name was Will Lodge. Both Lodge and Dighton were from Monticello. Dighton, as a matter of fact, was a relative of Robert's. And they would take John back to Monticello with them on weekends or for special events because at that time John's parents were dead. One was recently, his father had recently deceased. So they kind of felt sorry for John and took him around with him. And Robert was involved with the Campus Plan Commission, which was the group that helped organize where the new stadium was going to go, where it is now, the quad, et cetera. And all the frats were having their dad's day lunches. And Will and Aisler decided that, gee, it'd be really nice if John had a dad here, and he knows Robert. Why don't we get Robert to come and be his dad for the day? And that's how it all worked out.
Now, Robert Allerton had already given money to the university. He already had a relationship here with the university. And as a result, he was on this planned commission that was making these kind of decisions, like the construction of Memorial Stadium.
Right.
How old was he when he met John Gregg?
Well, Gregg
was about 22 or 23, I think, say in your book.
So Robert would have been about 49.
Okay.
About 48, 49, 50 when he met John.
And John eventually became an architect, but he mainly did work for Robert Allerton.
Right. He had a degree in chemical engineering because his brother convinced him that was the way to go because he, too, was a chemical engineer. But after he got it, he decided he didn't really want to do that. So he decided to leave Wisconsin and come to Illinois and get an architect degree. And as he was graduating, by then he knew Robert and had helped Robert with some small designs of things in gardens. Robert suggested to his friend David Adler, who was a famous architect, kind of like architect to the stars,
yes.
All the elegant homes that
Prairie Avenue in Chicago. Yes.
Well, and New England and all over. There's books about David Adler's designs. They're quite lovely. So anyway, David Adler hired John, and John worked there. And this would have been the late 20s, and he worked there for maybe 7 years or something like that. And it was the height of the Depression. David's business was suffering because a lot of people weren't building homes who might ordinarily have built them. Plus, David's wife had died in a horrible car crash, and he was desperately sad. So he just closed down his business. And at that time, John was coming down on weekends to visit Robert anyway, and he was staying in Robert's Chicago apartment. So it was a natural progression to say, well, just come on down here and stay here and help me with the sunken garden and help me with this, that, and the next thing.
How were gay relationships viewed in the 20s? Did this need to be kept completely secret?
Yeah, I think that's why. Well, you know, I'm backing up. I think originally they probably came together as a father and son in a foster environment might, and things, I think, naturally progress. I think they had a very complicated relationship. They weren't just father and son and lover. They were boss and employee. They were everything to each other. And if you think about many relationships, and no one relationship, I think, can be just simply categorized. But things were very, you know, kept under wraps. It was against the law, and there were all sorts of things, trying to arrest people. And my understanding is there was quite a gay high life in Chicago, and perhaps they went up to Chicago when they wanted to get a little clear of and have that kind of life. I'm not quite sure.
Uh-huh. Now, when this is jumping ahead, but when they built a place together in Hawaii and lived there, they apparently were more open about their relationship, and being gay was more accepted in the Hawaiian society. You tell in your book about a man who visited who was dealt with their investments, and they were nude the whole time he was there talking with them.
It was Wednesday. It was gardener's day off, so they could take their clothes off and be relaxed.
Yeah. And they had built a beautiful place on the island of Kauai that's
right.
Still available for people to visit because of its beautiful gardens.
Yes, it's lovely. And you can't walk unescorted because, unlike Allerton Park here, they didn't leave it in that way. It's for botanical research and helping with tropical plants, and so they want to be careful about going off
protecting all those things.
Right.
Yes, we're talking on Keeping the Faith today with Maureen Holtz, Holtz. She and Martha Bergen have published a book recently, just last year, Robert Allerton, The Private Man, The Public Gifts. So we're talking about Robert Allerton, his gifts to the University of Illinois of the Allerton Park, the Allerton Mansion, which is now a conference center the university has been using for many years since it was given. And he was a major donor to the arts and culture life of the city of Chicago, the largest donor during his lifetime to the Art Institute of Chicago, for example. If you have comments or questions, we're eager to have you join the conversation. Do give us a buzz, 333-9455 if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area. If it's a long-distance call, punch in 1-800-222-9455. We're happy to talk about his private life or his public philanthropy. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. We're about halfway through today. If you've missed part of this program, feel free in a week or so to go to the website at will.illinois.edu. When you have a choice of TV, FM, or AM, click on AM and you'll see the Keeping the Faith spot there, and you can see all of our previous programs that you can listen to at your convenience via computer. So again, that's will.illinois.edu. Next week on this program, I'll be interviewing Harry Strong by phone in Colorado. Faces of Faith, Walking Off the Pages of the Bible. Harry Strong is a Protestant minister, but also a gifted writer and actor, and has created many stories of biblical characters that he acts out, and he's well known around the many parts of the country for presenting these characters in services of worship. So that'll be July 25th. On August, later in August, on the 15th, we'll be treated to an interview with Craig Jessup, the former director of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, now dean of the College of Arts at Utah State University. We'll be talking about faith and music, and particularly the Mormon faith in relation to music. That'll be on August 15 here on Keeping the Faith. Well, let's get back to our guest today, Maureen Holtz. Maureen, talk about some of the art that people can see either at the Art Institute or at Allerton Park or at the Krannert Art Museum here at the University of Illinois that is there because of Robert Allerton.
Right. Well, I think the three most important pieces of work that are there, the Adam is a reproduction of a reproduction, but the original was a bronze statue that Robert bought from the Rodin studio in Paris, and he donated it to the Art Institute after he had had a reproduction created for himself, and it's in the middle, surrounded by the Four Seasons Gardens near the greenhouse. At Allerton Park. The original is at the Art Institute. But the other two most important statues that I think everybody will remember, besides the food dogs, is the Death of the Last Centaur. That was designed by a student of Rodin's. His name is Emile Antoine Bourdel. I was really blessed recently. My husband and I were in Paris in May, and I discovered that there's a Bourdel Museum, and there were several copies of the centaur there, another bronze, a plaster version, etc. So you can get totally surrounded by centaurs if you go to Paris and go to the Bourdel Museum. It's a beautiful piece of work. The other one that I think...
Before you go on, sure. Let me just, for listeners who've never been to the Allerton Park, who've never had the experience of being wandering on a trail through a woods and coming and looking up a rise and seeing this huge statue just surrounded by trees of this dying centaur, it's quite a moving experience.
It is, and there's four different paths you can
take to it.
One, when you leave the sunken garden and you're wandering and you're beating off the mosquitoes, all of a sudden you come to this opening, as you said. In the fall in particular, is incredible with the seasonal change of the colors. There are 60 steps that can go down then towards the riverbank, and there's a set of pylons near there. Or you could go in the opposite direction, and there's pylons that are closer to the road. You could keep on going on the path and keep on wandering down by the river, and eventually you will come to the Sun Singer, which is as far as you can get going in that direction, which was a statue that Robert bought in Stockholm. And as a matter of fact, I was just doing some research today, and both of the statues Robert bought with John in attendance in 1929. And both of the sculptors were students of Rodin. Carl Millis did the Sun Singer. About the same size statue stands overlooking the harbor in Stockholm, and that's where Robert saw it, and he asked for a replica of that. He had gone to visit
Millis. He wanted a smaller size, you report in your book.
He went to Millis's house, and in Millis's garden was a smaller version without a head and without arms, and through a translator he said, "I want that size, but with the head and arms, like in the harbor." But apparently Millis misunderstood and sent him the huge size with the head and arms. And Robert had to find a new home for it because he was planning on putting it on the terrace outside of his bedroom window. Instead, it would look in his window. So he bought some farmland farther down the road and put the Sun Singer there. Then there's the food dogs.
Before you leave the Sun Singer, again,
sure,
for people who've never visited the park, you can walk quite a ways or you can drive down, and there's a circular drive around the Sun Singer, and it's quite a marvelous statue, and to be able to see it from all sides as it is intended, and from a distance. It's quite a clearing in the woods there, so you can see it in the distance and you can get closer and see the details.
And sunset's incredible.
And that's right. And to see it in that setting, to see a sculpture and again in the middle of the woods in the Midwest is quite remarkable.
Right. And there's two other statues. Not that Robert found them, but they were I guess I could use the word stashed at Allerton Park after the university got them. They were by one's called the Bear and the Gorilla, and the other trying to remember the other name. It escapes me at the minute. And they were placed in the woods, and you'd come across this bear carrying off or a gorilla carrying off this woman. And
a nude woman, yes.
Yeah, and I guess it was upsetting to a lot of people. Robert had nothing to do with it. It was just they were put there, I think, to get them out of the way. They are now at the Cranon Art Museum, so you can go and see them. They're in the front door, I believe. A lot of the other work that Robert has, I think of him as still being there. there's a version of the Three Graces, which I'm sure people have seen, the Three Graces. And some of these statues do move around. Some of them stay put. The Chinese musicians have had several different homes over the years, as had the food dogs. And the food dogs are one of my particular favorites, and it's a good place to have a wedding, too.
What is a food dog?
A food dog looks like a kind of a lion and a dog, and it's a Chinese, a typical Chinese statue. And I understand they're just everywhere. They're not like anything special. But I can't remember how many there are out at the park. They have been
very colorful.
Oh, they're beautiful.
Porcelain-like.
Blue, yes. Kind of like the blue that you're wearing today.
Quite
very, very nice, bright blue with bug eyes, kind of looking almost like a Pekingese, but a little bit fiercer.
Tell us about the tower at the end of the food dog columns.
The filigree on top of the tower there was something that Robert saw when he was in Chicago and heading up on the north side of Chicago to a funeral, I believe. And they had been taking this filigree off of some structure. And he stopped and he said, "You know, I want that." And then on the way back, he made arrangements to have it shipped down here. And he put it up. And it's on top of the pavilion. And then in the pavilion is some statues from, I believe, Thailand. They all kind of run into one, and since we've written the book over a year ago, the brain's kind of gone dead. But there's several Asian statues there.
Robert Allerton's tastes were quite eclectic, and he was widely traveled. How was he educated?
He went to several schools in Chicago and also took some classes at the Art Institute. We actually got his grades. He didn't attend a lot of classes, but he attended some, and then he went off to Europe to study art.
And his gifts to the Art Institute, the University of Illinois, and other places were not money he earned. He inherited this. He managed the estate. He
right.
managed the portfolios.
Yes.
He was involved in the decisions of where the investments went, but he did inherit a lot of it. I'd like
yes.
to talk about his family, his
okay.
father, but we do have a caller on line 4 from Belgium. Line 4, you're on the air with our guest, Maureen Holtz. Go ahead.
Yes. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I spoke to you before when you had a little interview with Ms. Quinn, I think.
Right, right.
A year or so ago. And at that time, I asked you about the snakes in the park.
Right, I remember that.
Yeah. But now I'd like to ask you another little question. It's
sure.
a little different in this vein. Monticello itself has an interesting history in that it's a very, very, what's the word I want? It's a very urbane small town for central Illinois, if you know what I mean.
Right.
A lot of nice older homes and everything. Was there a relationship between Mr. Allerton and the, what was that? It was the patent medicines?
The pepsin syrup.
Yes.
Yes. Not that I could find. He had relatives that lived there. The Dightons, as I mentioned, was one of them. And the Kratz family, I think, were just close friends. And later, other relatives. I think I can't remember exactly who came first, the chicken or the egg, although I have heard that's been solved. Anyway, the Dighton family were related to him, and they were all involved in farming, and I think later they were also involved in banking, but nothing that I could find involved in the medicine world. There was just a lot of farmers there.
Did Mr. Allerton and these people? Because there was an opera house there. Was
yes. The what
there
is?
There was a lot of nice things were going on in Monticello.
Right. If you've been to Monticello, you've seen the library, and it's the Agnes Allerton Library. It was named after his stepmother because his mother died after she contracted the scarlet fever that deafened him, and his father married his wife's younger sister, Agnes, who nurtured the love of opera and art. And in around 1894, thereabouts, if I remember correctly, the township, Monticello Township, wanted to put up a township hall and opera house. And that building housed their township offices, the opera, and the turreted area on the main floor was the library, and since then the rest of the main floor basically became the library with a little bit of space for the township offices. The opera house, I believe, was upstairs, and there used to be an auditorium there, and they've reconditioned that. It is an auditorium. It doesn't have seats now.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call, and other callers are welcome. 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area here near the University of Illinois, where the studio is here, of course, for WILL AM 580. If it's a long-distance call, punch in 1-800-222-9455. Let's talk a little bit more about his family. You mentioned his mother dying at an early age, his father marrying her sister Agnes. Tell us about his father.
Oh, well, his father sounds like a very fascinating man that deserves his own book, maybe someday. Kind of short and bullish. I think he would have been played by somebody like Ed Asner or Carol O'Connor, more like Ed Asner, I think. And he was a self-made man who came west from New York and was involved in the livestock industry. Went back to New York to try and make his fortune, and then later came back to Chicago and started making his fortune in by cornering the hog market in 1863 when the Union Army needed pork very desperately. It was during that time, his name was Samuel Allerton, it was during that time that Samuel thought that there really needed to be a more centralized version of Stockyards. So later, very soon thereafter, he and several others joined together and helped get the Chicago Stockyards started. So that helped with the money. And he also came up with, thought because of the problems that he ran into trying to get loaner money to buy up these hogs, he wanted a centralized bank. So he joined with other people shortly thereafter in starting the First National Bank of Chicago, which is now Chase Bank. And he stayed one of the directors from 1863 until the date of his death in 1914. So between the livestock industry and the banking industry, Sam did quite well, to the point that the Tribune back in the early 1900s named him the third richest man in Chicago. He ran for mayor, actually.
Now, as a result of that family money, at one point early in his adult life, Robert Allerton was named also by the Chicago Tribune as the most eligible bachelor in Chicago, and he was sort of pushed into relationships with, they weren't allowed sort of to date then, but in his segment of society, but young women could go in groups with other eligible men, and there were some young beauties who were mentioned in the society pages as his consorts. Tell us particularly about Ellen Bay Emmel.
Emmett. Well, Ellen, he didn't meet in Chicago. He met Ellen, we believe, in New York City. She had gone off to Paris to study painting along with some cousins. There's a great book that's been written by her granddaughter about her, Ellen Emmett. Her nickname was Bay. I have no idea why. I could never find out why. But anyway, she was a very accomplished artist and came back and was supporting her extended family. She had a ne'er-do-well stepfather who basically abandoned the family, so she was responsible for keeping everybody going. And she was just popping out portraits and work by the ton. And somewhere along the line, Robert met her. It could have been when she moved to Washington Square and he was living there briefly in New York City, or it could have been in Paris or England. But in any case, we interviewed the granddaughter, who's also named Ellen Emmett, she was just made my day when she said, "Oh, I was going through the barn 10 years ago after my father died, and I came across a cache of letters that Robert wrote to Ellen. Would you care for them?" And, of course, I couldn't wait to get my hands on them. So I have 28 letters that Robert wrote to Ellen starting in 1901. And in the first one, I'm gathering this might have been one of the very first letters he wrote, because he says, "Dear Miss Emmett, it's May 1901, and he's making arrangements for her to come west from New York to, he's commissioned her to paint a portrait of his father at Lake Geneva, because the parents had a place in Lake Geneva, a summer place. And he was also going to then work on, she was going to work on Robert's portrait as well. And he was very excited about her then coming down to Monticello and visiting the farms and riding the horses and seeing the place, etc." And then subsequent letters move on very quickly to showing how much he has grown to care for her and how jealous he gets about her lack of attention and in the direction he'd like it to go, apparently.
And by then he's calling her Ellen.
Dear Ellen, and right, signing much love and so forth. And before I found those letters, before we got those letters, I had examined some letters in the Smithsonian that you can get on loan from Interlibrary Loan. And her family was very prolific in the art world. And there was a letter that Henry James, who was Ellen's second cousin, wrote saying, "I expect that Robert will be marrying Bay very soon." And then another letter, "It's a shame that her mother won't let her marry Robert." Uh-huh. So there's some mystery there.
You mentioned earlier that Robert took a early trip in his early 20s with a young man named Frederick, mm-hmm, to Europe. Was it possible that they were involved in a gay
relationship? Well, you know, it's interesting because a lot of the people that are involved in the Friends house, it's now open to the public down in Fort Lauderdale. There's some conjecture that there might have been a relationship between the two of them, and maybe that's why he burnt his paintings and came home. Even Frederick's third wife thought, you know, it's possible. But who knows? I mean, Frederick did get married three times. Of course, that doesn't mean anything.
Sure. We have another caller on line one from Champaign. You're on the air with our guest, Maureen Holtz, the author of Robert Allerton, The Private Man, The Public Gifts. Go right ahead. Line number one.
Hi, hello. I wanted to make another comment about Allerton's gifts to the university. My wife is a Allerton fellow. When she was studying architecture here at the university.
Hi, Ken.
Hi, how are you? And we had a great time traveling through New England on that fellowship, studying New England architecture one summer.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that's one thing I hadn't yet gotten into. It was in the 20s after he met John Gregg that he started instituting a scholarship to architects and landscape architects to take journeys because he firmly believed that you could absorb a lot by seeing what's already out there.
It was a lot of fun in that, you know, sitting in a classroom viewing the photographs of various buildings, it doesn't do it justice. But once you actually can visit the buildings and walk through them, you do get a much better appreciation of them. So it really was quite exciting for us to do that.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Seeing the great buildings of the world is one of the main reasons to travel.
Right. Definitely. And that's actually what he insisted with John Gregg, that John go on a trip around Europe before he started with David Adler. And John tells stories about being on a tramp steamer, et cetera. And it was because of that, it really made an impression on Robert that he wanted to do this scholarship, and it still exists.
Ken, before you leave, let me ask. One thing I learned from the book was that the Allerton Fellows in Architecture received $400 a semester when it was set up. Is it more now?
It's quite a bit more generous.
I'm glad to hear that.
So the endowment has grown.
Definitely.
Very good. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ken.
What else have I forgotten to ask about to show the generosity of Robert Allerton?
Well, I found it really interesting that there was so much that he and his mother did for Chicago hospitals. His mother in particular, his stepmother, was very involved in hospital work. And when his father died in 1914, Robert, of course, it being in those days, the son always got the majority of things in the will, he got the house, which was quite palatial in Prairie Avenue. He sold it to the Hump Hairpin Factory and then gave the proceeds to a hospital. And then he created a trust fund in the name of the doctor who had looked after his father. He also made sure, and I think this was in his will, that he endowed an association for three nurse fellowships in the names of Allerton family members. He did other things, like, for example, for people who aren't aware, there's Lodge Park out at north of Monticello. John Gregg designed the gates, the pillars for that, and Robert and many other people helped fund that forest preserve. He helped. One thing we learned since the book came out, this person came up to my co-author and said that her father had been recovering from malaria during World War II, and this was when Robert and John were out in Hawaii, and Robert saw on the list of people who were, sick there that one person was from Monticello, Illinois. So he insisted that they allow the soldier to recuperate at his Kauai estate. and Robert's and the young soldier, because you had to be careful of what you wrote in your letters, he only wrote back home saying, I was visiting Robert Allerton.
I see.
And that's how people knew
where he was.
Where he was, yes. So these are the constant little surprises that Marty and I found as we went. Was, you know, he liked to be generous. He didn't necessarily want to be asked, but he wanted it to be his idea.
Now, in terms of any religious background or tradition, his family, you write, were Universalists.
Right.
Which was
Unitarian, kind of.
Well, Unitarians joined the Universalists later, but at that time it was sort of a separate denomination and rather a minority.
Right,
Did that go back very far in the family? Did you happen to find that out?
I didn't. We didn't find that out. Okay. I think it might have been just a measure of where they were in Chicago, et cetera. And it's a possible that when he one of the things I forgot to say is when he did go to school, he went out to boarding school in New Hampshire at St. Paul's, and he left school because he refused to do his Bible studies. as Marty pointed out, she felt she discovered that the guy who did the Bible studies was really kind of a hater of the religion that Robert was known to be. I don't think Robert was that involved in religion. I think it was just one of these things.
But a Universalist in those years would have been considered a heretic by many Christians.
So.
Yeah.
I think so.
Okay. Not so much now. Let's go to another caller on line number one in Champaign. Yes, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I tuned in late, so I may have missed any comments you made about the gift of Robert Allerton to the university, the property and the mansion, estate, and so forth. What were the terms and conditions, and did the gift include resources to maintain the property over the years? And I'll listen off here.
That's a very good question. We have talked about a little bit about that, but not about the terms of the gift or the lack of resources to maintain it.
Right, right. In 1946, October 1946, he gave a certain amount of acreage to the university, the house and some of the land. The property was supposed to be a public park and research entity for, you know, whatever they wanted to do with the land. He didn't even particularly care if they kept the house. But he said he didn't want it to become a hotel or a place for weddings. Look what's happened. The land, the farms themselves that went to the university were supposed to be the resource for the money. And I know that the university has struggled for decades trying to work with just the resources that were left with that. I know I saw one letter from George Stoddard, the president, kind of begging for more money, and Robert saying, no, I don't think so. I think you've got what you're going to get.
And interestingly, your book reports that in some of the last days of the 1940s, when Robert Allerton still was running the farms, although he was in Hawaii, he was having trouble paying the bills. There wasn't enough income coming from the farmland produce to pay for the upkeep of the gardens and the mansion. And he had how many gardeners and how many housekeepers and how many...
Well, I think it was, he just had the funds. Early on, he struggled before his father died. And then after his father died, then, of course, he was kind of king of the castle, so to speak, and he had a lot more income coming in, and he could kind of live off that and be a little whimsical with his expenditures.
But he was living rather high in Hawaii and traveling a great deal and buying more art.
Right.
Much of which he gave away.
Right.
But the farms he was no longer quite so interested in.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think it was part of it is because we found instances of blackmail from some of the staff, and he probably at that point he was getting older and thought, oh geez, you know, I'm not going to be able to find people I can trust anymore. The few people that are left, you know, it's just going to be too difficult. Let me give it. Do I give it to the state or do I give it to the university? Which one could screw it up less? And that was his decision.
And the issue of blackmail for someone who was gay at that period and even today continues to be a major problem.
Right. Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're nearing the end of our time. Let me ask you quickly about his deafness.
Well, I think considering he was thought to be fairly deaf, he did pretty well going to operas and mingling with lots of people. He did go to, I think it was Austria, to see if there was anything they could do. It was a clinic run by a doctor named Politzer, not Pulitzer, as some people had previously reported. And there was limited success with his sister, not so much with him. He benefited much better once hearing aids came out. Strangely enough, I was so thrilled. Kauai is where a lot of movies are, and there was a picture in this book of where they showed a lot of movies being made in Kauai, and there was a picture of John Wayne standing talking to this older man, and I looked at the picture, and it was Robert, and I recognized him because of the hearing aid and just his face, of course.
Sure.
But so he did much better once the hearing aids came in.
We've been talking about the book Robert Allerton, the Pratt. In our last minute, let me just mention one thing. You repeat in the book that the Allertons made claims to be direct descendants from the Allerton that was on the Mayflower. I did happen to find out that the Mayflower Society does not recognize that claim. It's possible there's some other relationship. There was an Allerton that was a boy on the Mayflower who did not stay in the Plymouth colonies, was sent back to England. It's probably worth investigating whether there might have been a tie there.
Well, actually, since the book has come out, I discovered some, you know, dispute about that he is descended from an Allerton, the Isaac Allerton, but whether it's from the line of Isaac Allerton that they claim in their book that was written, that's another thing.
At least the Mayflower Society says not. But
yeah. Well, there's all sorts of that's just a whole another can of worms.
It is indeed. Well, it's a fascinating book, wonderful photographs by your husband. So thank you very much, Maureen Holtz, for being our guest today on Keeping the Faith. Next week we'll be talking with Harry Strong by phone about Faces of Faith walking off the pages of the Bible. And then later in August on the 15th with Craig Jessup, the former director of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, about music in relation to particularly the Mormon faith. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.